This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Manchester's indie rock and roll station, XS Manchester.
The XS Manchester Long Player, an iconic album in full with Jim Salverson.
XS Manchester.
Hello, I'm Jim and welcome to the XS Long Player. Classic albums discussed with the people who made those albums. It's a special one today as I talk to Andy Williams from Doves about The Last Broadcast. The second album from the band and an album that has just at the time of putting out this podcast celebrated its 20th anniversary, released back in April of 2002. Can't quite believe that was 20 years ago. It was a hugely successful album for the band. It got to number one in the album's charts and also spawned their still highest charting single to date in There Goes the Fear. I really enjoyed this chat with Andy. He talks about the making of the album, why one of the song titles on the album is wrong, and how this was an LP that helped change perceptions of the band. If you like what you hear, make sure you check out the back catalogue of XS Long Players. Loads of brilliant people talking about their brilliant albums. So go and check it out and enjoy this. Andy from Doves talking about The Last Broadcast. How you doing, Andy?
Good, thanks. Good, thanks. How are you?
I'm really good, Tar. Now, I've mentioned that I'm doing this interview to a couple of people and explained the context behind it, that The Last Broadcast is 20 years old this year, and the reaction in general has been, nah, mate, nah, it's not 20 years old. Does it feel that long ago you made it?
Yes and no, I guess. Mm. Yeah, I mean, I'm really surprised it's that long ago, but yeah, a lot's happened, I guess, in that interim, but yeah, it's certainly, in a lot of ways, it doesn't feel like 20 years.
Do you still connect with the songs on the album after all this time? Do they have the same meaning as they did 20 years ago to you now when you look back at them?
Yeah, I mean, I guess like a lot of musicians, I don't really tend to play back old records. No. You know, it's kind of, once you work so hard on an album, which we did this and all of them, afterwards you just don't, apart from playing live, you don't really want to listen to them again. I mean, it's nice if you hear them on the radio or whatever, and I'll listen then, and it will take me back to that time. But actually, the first time I did listen to the record was in lockdown when we did Tim Burgess's, you know, the listening party. I would listen to it from start to finish, and it was like, yeah, it was quite emotional, really, because I hadn't listened to it from start to finish since we did it. And yeah, I was pleasantly surprised, yeah, that, and I still did connect to the songs, you know, most of them anyway.
When you sat down and listened to it for the listening party, were there moments that caught you off guard during it, sort of things that jumped out of the album that kind of took you right back to those studio sessions or that you didn't remember doing or anything like that?
Yeah, it was a few times, like just stuff you totally forget about. But yeah, just I think being in Jimmy's living room, he was in Northenden, him and Jez were in Northenden at the moment, which kind of comes into the album actually, because we certainly wrote it all pretty much in Normandy at Jez's studio. He had a little studio in his terrace house there, and we wrote most of it then. But we used to sort of bop between Jimmy and Jez's house. Like I said, we're both in Normandy. But The Sulphur Man, I just remember us all had a title. I remember having a title, The Sulphur Man, but I didn't have any lyrics. And we had most of the music done for it. But I just remember being in this front room. It was nothing of any big consequence, but I just remember us all trading lyrics between each other, you know, and it was one of those times where it really flowed between, in terms of lyrics, generally lyrics, one of us would go off and write them and then we might sort of collaborate a little bit. But this was pretty, all the lyrics was a total collaboration, and we got it done in an afternoon. And yeah, I just remember it was like, you know, we sat there having a coffee, got, you know, some biscuits, got through the whole song, happy with it. Right, let's go to the Farm's Arms pub. Yeah, just incidents like that, and maybe a couple of memories of Real World. We mixed a couple of tracks at Real World in Bath. That's Peter Gabriel's gaff. And just some really good times at the end of the record. Yeah, I guess it did, you know, raise a few memories.
want to drill down into a couple of the songs in a bit. Also, I want to talk about that Northenden connection shortly. But in general, I mean, it's a cliche to say difficult second album, but it's a cliche because quite often it's true. And I think it can be a challenge, not least because of the time that you get to write a second album compared to your first album, but also because there's quite often a change in dynamic for the band. Now, for the second album, I seem to remember you got into the studio pretty much straight off the back of the Lost Souls tour. There wasn't much gap between them. So how prepared were you at the point when you got into the studios? Did you have songs ready to go? Was it a blank sheet of paper?
No, there were a couple of songs. I think Jez had started what became There Goes the Fear. And there might have been a couple of other songs, but it was without doubt our fastest album to make. You know, the albums like Some Cities, which took like 4 years. This really, for us, was a fast record. I know it was still like a year, year and a half, but for us, that was quite fast. So, yeah, but other than that, I think we were really buoyed by how well Lost Souls had done, really. I think that was like the main thing going into this record. We were kind of feeling a lot more hopeful and thinking, you know, actually beginning to think we could maybe, this could be our full-time job. We don't have to get other jobs, which was a nice thing to face, really, because Lost Souls was really tricky making. It was a really tricky record to make, and there were certainly some dark days on that record. But this was fast, and we were at the wind in our sails. We'd been around the world a couple of times touring Lost Souls. You know, I had some unbelievable times. So I guess there was some kind of sort of wind in our sails, really, which we carried through on the recording.
I've heard Jimmy say in previous interviews that when you went into the studio, you had this determination as a band to change the perception, change how people saw you. Why was that?
I think we got the usual thing of miserable Northerners. Or miserable bin men, to be precise. Remember that.
So was this kind of an attempt to do something a bit more upbeat, a bit more anthemic?
I wouldn't say anthemic. No, we never really intentionally tried to make a track anthemic. It's nice if people connect with it, and you know, a few people do, and maybe that becomes an anthem. But yeah, we wanted to make a brighter record. We wanted to try and surprise people, I guess. So yeah, I think we were just feeling brightener ourselves, really. You know, for most of the record, not all of the record, there were kind of, you know, as always, you know, a year and a half in anybody's life, there's going to be good and bad times. But on the whole, we were feeling really buoyed by it all, and really just we can make a living doing this. Isn't that great?
So you mentioned the Northenden thing earlier and the fact you were still in Manchester. Album number one was recorded out in Cheetham Hill, I think. And then you went into centre Manchester to record this album. Was that a deliberate, conscious thing to keep it in the Northwest, to keep it in Manchester? Because in the early noughties, when this was being made, the industry was still pretty London-centric. And other artists I've spoken to said the record labels wanted them to go to London, where the producers and the studios were. Did you get that same temptation? And was it a deliberate thing to go, no, we're staying in Manchester, we're staying where our roots are?
Yeah, I think we had, you know, quite an understanding record company at the time. I mean, actually, we've always been quite lucky in that regard. We've always worked with people who get it and gave us a, you know, massive amount of kind of creative freedom. But we were working with Heavenly Records at the time, and that was Jeff Barrett and Martin Kelly. And they got it, and they, you know, left it up to us, really. So they never really pressurised us to go to London. They, you know, as I say, we did, you know, certainly all the demos in Jez's little place in Northenden. And I guess, you know, when we started delivering the demos, they could see the bigger picture and see that, you know, well, we sort of knew what we were doing. So there was no, you know, there was one song actually, two songs actually, where we did work with Steve Osborne, a producer, where we couldn't crack, you know, there were good songs. It was Caught by the River, yeah, and Satellites. So good songs.
Yeah.
But we just lost our way a little bit with them. So they suggested for those two songs that we work with Steve as like a co-production and go to Real World. But by this point, we'd broken the back of the album. We'd had most of it done. So it was like, you know what? Let's go and have some, you know, nice catering and some nice food at the Bosch studio down near Bath, because we deserve it. And it was a really good move in the end, because he really, you know, we cracked those songs with him.
What did he bring to that process? What did Steve Osborne, because he would have at that point, he would have worked with Mondays, I think. He would have worked on some significant Manchester albums. So he had a reputation in this city. So what was he bringing to the process at that point?
Yeah, gets a sort of clarity of thought, really. And just we'd actually worked with him on one song on Lost Souls on Catch the Sun. And that song, again, was a really tough song for us to crack. And he heard it live. I remember hearing that song live and he's going, right, you just need to record it how you're playing it live. We were kind of like going around the houses a bit with it and go, no, it can't be. You know, we want to do something different than live. We want to break it down, maybe add a drum machine and stuff. And he just came through with clarity of thought, said, no, I think he heard like, we did a session on Steve Lamack on Radio 1 where we did that song. And he was like, no, that we need to get it like that. We need to, you know, record that energy. And he was very much encouraged us to try and play live in the studio rather than tracking. And so again, with Satellites and Caught by the River, especially Caught by the River, he really encouraged us to do as much live as possible and just brought an energy to it. And yeah, he's very musical as well, Steve. And I think we learned quite a bit off him, actually.
I want to talk about a couple of your highlights off the album shortly. So I'm hoping you're going to pick a couple of tracks for us to sort of dig into. But there's a couple that I wanted to mention before we do that. One goes back to the Northenden thing, and it's the M62 song. And I was browsing Wikipedia before I did this chat and noticed that, according to Wikipedia, the M62 song was recorded under the M62 flyover in Northenden. Now, that can't be true because there isn't an M62 flyover in Northenden. But what element?
We got it wrong.
Okay,
it was the M60 flyover.
Okay, so it was recorded under the flyover, but the title was wrong.
Yeah, and some of the guitars were, yeah. And we just got the wrong motorway. It sounds better M62 song than the M60 song. Yeah, it was only later we thought, oh, somebody told us. I think Dave, our manager, was like, you know, because he lives in Northampton as well. Mm. He was like, you know, the motorway you recorded under, it's not the M62, it's the M60. By this point, it had already sort of gone to being printed up, the labels, and we're like, all right, well, M62 song it is.
Brilliant. The other one I wanted to talk about is one of the most well-known songs on the album, There Goes the Fear. And one of my favourite bits of any song in the world ever, actually, is the what I used to call the monkey noise at the end of it. And I found out recently from a South American friend is actually an instrument called a cusia, I think. Who brought that to the table? Who went, here's an idea, here's how we're going to end this song? Because it's really difficult in my head. I imagine a lot of these songs would have had to start on an acoustic guitar. That's kind of how most songs get their genesis. But to go from that, to go from something big and grand, whether it's got strings on it or brass or acousia, that must be a really difficult process.
Yeah, to pull off, it can, we've tried it, not particularly with like a samba band, but we've tried with other things and we haven't pulled it off. Just luckily this time we did. I can't remember exactly who thought of that. Possibly Jez. Possibly said, you know, I think the idea was like almost, you know, like somebody who's DJing and bringing in quite juxtaposed music, really, from what's been before. And that would have been the idea, I guess, with Jez. And we were just lucky it kind of worked. Jimmy knew, he had a good friend called Mark Starr, who's an old friend of his and ours. And he works for samba groups or Brazilian groups. And so he knew people who you know, those musicians. So it was just a phone call to him. And I think we recorded it in the fire escape at Greenhouse. There was this old rehearsal studio in Stockport called Greenhouse. Mm-hmm. And he used to have this big fire escape. We did the drums down there on a kind of like, I don't know, Tuesday evening or something, a rainy Tuesday evening. And we were like, right, this is working.
Did you enjoy exploring the spaces around the studio as much as the studio? You talked about recording in a fire escape there. You mentioned the flyover under the M60 earlier. Was that kind of part of what the band did? You looked at different ways of making music?
I think just to try and have some fun with it. I think the under the motorway thing is when we went to Real World, we heard a story of Griff from Super Furry Animals recording a vocal out on a boat on the lake for Super Furry Animals. And we're like, oh, that's really cool, you know. So we're like, well, let's try and do our version of that. And I think the song, M62 song, did have a sample of some cars going by. And we were just like, I was just like, well, why don't we just try that and see how it works? But just to try and keep, it's definitely something we've always tried to do is move around quite a bit, really. Mm. You know, it's easy kind of to get a bit stale if you're in the same studio all the time. And, you know, it can just disrupt things if you go to a totally different location and just mix it up a bit. It's something that's always benefited us, even to this day, really. Just keep on moving. You just get like you know, fresh ideas and get inspired all over again, you know.
Pick me a couple of highlights off this album for you, Andy. Well, I say highlights, they can be lowlights, they can be just memories, little bits you remember that are connected to certain tracks. What would you like to kind of pick out of the last broadcast?
Okay, hopefully I was going to mention M62, but okay. And The Fear. But yeah, I guess I remember that There Goes The Fear. It's maybe not a personal memory, but I remember the label, Heavenly, suggesting, because it was the first single off the album, they're suggesting, right, we're going to put this out, but we're going to delete it on the day that it's released. Mm. And we were all like, what? Are you mad? You know? One day, the second day you can't get hold of them and said, yeah, we're just going to delete it. Yeah, I just remember us all thinking, they were mad about that one. But they were right. Yeah, they're right. It was a gamble, a real gamble. And I don't know if these days that sort of thing would work at all, but it did. It really worked. It really created a kind of a bit of a buzz at the time. And the people who were into the band, you know, all went out on that first day and got it. And it just created a bit of a kind of a buzz.
You did a similar thing with Pounding and Caught by the River as well, didn't you? I don't know whether they were deleted on the same day, but it was certainly limited edition releases. Was it purely that? Was it to create a buzz? Or was it to push early sales and trying to get that chart position? Or was there something a little bit more arty behind it and kind of a little bit more free thinking?
I'd like to say it was a bit more arty, but probably not. Probably more commerce, really. I don't know, really. I mean, I think it was a genuine attempt from the label to create some excitement around us coming back after Lost Souls. So, yeah, I don't think there was anything kind of artistic in it, really. Just flocking more records, basically.
Well, like you say, it worked. Go on, is there another track or highlight off the album you'd like to flag up?
I guess Satellites. We did that one with Steve Osborne, and that was touch and go whether we were going to, you know, such a fine line sometimes with songs, whether they're going to make it or not. It generally happened with us. If one of us gets a downer on the song, it never ended up on the record. So we knew it was a good song, but we were starting to kind of get a bit stale on it, really. And that's when it was suggested we work with Steve. And I think Steve helped us with the intro, which were these kind of really crunched up claps and these stomps. I remember doing like foot stomps in the studio, and we got that kind of bit of a, you know, the intro on it, which is kind of very crunchy, you know, percussive hand claps. And that to us really kind of helped the song start off in a less traditional way. Again, I think what he brought to that track was really good. He, you know, insisted on a lot of live takes in there. He created some magic in the studio in terms of recording sounds, and yeah, so good memories of that. And we were at Real World again, just good times, you know. It was like towards the end of the album, it was almost done, and we had the latecomer of Pounding. That was the last song we did on the record. That was another good memory that came really late, that we thought the album was done. And then
what came first with that song? Was it the because I always listen to that and think it's the most perfect title for that record, and the way it starts and it comes in, and it's kind of, the title's very descriptive of how that tune feels. Was it a case of you went, well, we've got this tune and these lyrics suggest this, so we're going to give it that feeling in the music, or how did that kind of form from?
Yeah, well, the title was from the demo when there was no lyrics.
Okay.
And obviously wrote the lyrics. I think it was a bit of collaboration on the lyrics. And I remember us having a meeting, and we were, you know, talking through the track listing. We were like, oh no, we can't call it Pounding. Nah, I mean, you know, in the chorus it says now or never, or, you know, there's other lyrics. We can't call it Pounding. And then Dave, our manager, and Jeff Barrett, and I was like, no, it's really just, it's descriptive. It's, you know, it's not a lyric in the song. So yeah, that's just, we went with it, really. And yeah, it's kind of weird how titles become their own thing, really, because, you know, obviously it gets used quite a lot on the football now. And obviously the song has got absolutely nothing to do with football, but just because of the title Pounding, it's still getting used at Man City every week, you know? So that's something I'm eternally grateful for, you know?
Now, this is, I mean, critically a hugely successful album for you. It was nominated for the Mercury Music Prize, just lost out to Miss Dynamite in the end. Commercially, a really successful album. But when you look back on it, when you look at the body of your work, be it Doves or be it the other bands you've been in, artistically, would you say this was your most successful album?
No, I kind of, I think it, I don't want to sound, you know, a big edit, but I do think each album we've done has had its own character. And for me personally, obviously other people are going to totally disagree and everyone's got their own. For me, each record has its own character and has its own place, really. I don't see really albums in, when it's your own records. I don't see them in isolation, really. I see it as hopefully, you know, a body of work, I guess, you know. Yeah. And it's always been about the long term with us, really. Mm. And trying to make music, sometimes successfully and sometimes not, that it's going to kind of last, really. Yeah, so it's all, I don't see one record in particular being better than any other. And I know loads of people will disagree with that, because I know a lot of people love the first album, a lot of people love the second album, but then I hear people have, you know, Some Cities and people like the last one, you know. So, yeah, anyway, sorry, very long answer to your question there.
I get exactly. Art's an objective thing, isn't it? It's like not everyone has to like the same stuff. People can have favourites. It's completely all right. You don't have to judge one thing against the other necessarily, because things can be brilliant in their own right.
Yeah, that's the joy of it. That's the joy of it. You know, I mean, I know why people do. You know, I do. My favourite bands are, oh, yeah, that's my favourite album by them. You know, it's obviously a natural thing. But I think with just looking at your own work, you know, there's songs which have not worked, I never want to hear again, you know, especially from a previous band. So, you know, there's a couple of things where we took massive missteps. But generally, you know, I'm pretty pleased with each, not that sitting around listening to them, but I know I'm kind of pleased, you know, with each record, and it was like the best we could do at the time, you know. We've never those gone, oh, that'll do, wash it out, you know. We're up against the clock here. We've always were quite thorough, really, that all three of us had to go, yeah.
Andy, pleasure to speak to you about The Last Broadcast, which I know for a lot of people is a much-loved album inside and outside Manchester. 20th anniversary, can't quite believe it. Hopefully there's plenty more to come from Doves in the future, so we'll keep our eyes and ears peeled for when and where that happens. But thank you very much for your time on the XS Long Player.
Been a pleasure. Thanks, Mum.
The XS Manchester Long Player, an iconic album in full with Jim Salverson.
XS Manchester.
If that hasn't made you want to go back and listen to The Last Broadcast in full, then I don't know what will. Awesome chat with Andy about that classic album from Doves. And if you want to check out the other podcasts in the XS Long Player series, there are loads more to go at, particularly if you're a fan of Manchester music, because there's more than that city's fair share of albums featured so far in this series. Also, if you like what you hear, do hit subscribe and do leave a review as well, because it really helps other people find this podcast. Have a good one, and I'll see you soon for another XS Long Player.
The XS Manchester Long Player, an iconic album in full with Jim Salverson.
XS Manchester.